This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Ibaka trying to stay with Durant. Knocks it away and Durant's limping. Durant goes down holding his leg. Ibaka goes up and is fouled down the other end. And Durant grabbing that right leg.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. The injury heard around the NBA landscape, and we are delighted to welcome in Dr. Brian Cole. He, of course, The Score's medical expert, Medicine Weekly, Saturdays, 8 a.m. on The Score, and, of course, a man that that is a orthopedic surgeon at Rush. Dr. Cole, good morning.
Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, David. Good morning, Michael.
You know, so I think there's so many things to talk about here with the Kevin Durant situation. Let's start with that type of injury for that type of player. I mean, Kevin Durant is a 7-foot jump shot shooter in a lot of ways. I mean, he's not a guy that necessarily rely. He makes a joke out of scoring. He doesn't rely on his interior offense to carry him. He can shoot from any distance. Does that make it easier to come back from this sort of injury? I mean, our understanding is this is usually, if it's a ruptured Achilles, a full year type of injury. Will there be, once you fix that thing, will there be any long-term issues with it if he takes care of it as we know NBA players do?
Well, first thing is, has anyone been told that there is a rupture?
Right.
He walked off the court. He was moving his foot up and down at the time of the injury. There was really no clear indication, in my mind, at least watching clinically, that it was a rupture. Although he certainly was holding himself down, you know, he was holding his Achilles during the time, okay? And it looked like he was assessing it, but it didn't look like he had ruptured it. So wondering if you guys have heard something that I haven't heard. Are you, so
no, no, it's a lot of speculation right now, Brian.
Yeah. So I'm going to say, you know, if I was looking at it statistically, He probably did not rupture it, okay? But that being said, let's talk about, you know, his height, the nature of this injury, and, you know, and all the things that go around it when making decisions about returning an athlete back to play after having recently had an injury. Obviously, given his height, he has huge lever arms. The Achilles and the foot and ankle still are one of the number one areas in the NBA that are associated with injury and time loss. It's one of our biggest buckets, and it's something that the NBA is committed, and the NBA research community is committed to trying to identify ways to reduce the incidence of it and how to identify ways to safely get it back to sport. So it's an inherent injury in this sport. As far as what's going to happen going forward, as you say, it's purely speculative. I'm going to guess it's not a full tear, and I'm going to even go as far as saying that I think it's not likely, based on looking at him clinically, that it's going to require surgery, but I could be wrong. He's going to get evaluated this morning with an MRI and a physical exam. But the way he was walking, he certainly wasn't walking as if he tore his Achilles. But I think the hardest issue, and I'm sure this is the one that people, you know, find interesting to speak about, is how you make decisions in getting him back to play. And I'm happy to answer any of those questions, because there's a whole lot of personal responsibility that's felt by different stakeholders here that, you know, I think it's part of the equation, part of the dogma in professional sports, is that injuries happen, and we do our best to keep our athletes safe. We do our best to keep them healthy and make conscientious, consensual decisions with the athlete when we decide to return them to play, especially after coming off, you know, a 4-week period of relative rest.
That's the crux of this, Brian. I mean, how tricky is that relationship between the player and the team doctor and the team officials and the coach and all of the basketball reasons in play versus the medical reasons, and whose voice is the loudest? And what have, in your experiences, you know, have informed you to see how this has changed over the years, if it has?
So, you know, this is a big box, and it takes a lot of headspace to sort of dissect it, but I want to keep it simple. You know, these decisions are consensual decisions. It is rare that one individual is polarized with a different expectation and different understanding of a problem like this. So, you know, the way it typically works is we sit down with the athlete and we say, look, you're going out on the court. This is a high-stakes situation. And we all know at any given time injury is possible. And am I at higher incidence of injury or re-injury given what's just happened? Yes. Can you play? Is your pain tolerable? Is your function normal enough that you're going to deliver something to the team? It's really all about pain and function and then protecting the athlete downstream from doing something that's irreversible and understanding the consequences. And this is a statistical issue. And the problem is statistics with numbers that we can't pin down. So we have to go by relative probabilities. If a player says, look, am I at a higher probability of a re-injury coming off 4 weeks? The answer is definitively yes. If I get re-injured, is it something that could change the course of my career? It might require a year, I may never be the same. That is unlikely, but it's possible. Is it possible I've never had an injury over the next 4 to 6 weeks that I could go out and do the same thing? Absolutely, right? But the numbers are lower. And you know, this is something, it's like actuarial science, but you're making it in the context of the system. And there are many, many stakeholders in these systems. There's the agent, there's the GM, there's the players, there's the pressure of the players. I mean, this is, when you watch this thing play out in the media about why isn't he playing? I mean, people just don't get it. These decisions are not made in a vacuum. They're made consensually with an organization, and I know that organization pretty well. They're just like virtually every other organization in the NBA. They make it consensually, and they make a conscientious decision that everybody knows has a level of risk, but we're also looking at what's at stake. If this was a preseason game, he probably would not be back, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you make a decision knowing that this is possible but not necessarily probable. And the public and the media love to think linearly, and they say, well, what about the playing 12 of 14 minutes? What about the number of minutes he played the game before? You know, what about the fact that the humidity was high? You know, there are a tremendous number of independent variables that you and I cannot control, and to think linearly that we could rewind the clock and anyone should beat themselves up over this, I think just isn't really, it's not fruitful, and it's not actually warranted, in my opinion, because that's not how the decisions are made. They're not done in a vacuum.
I understand what you're saying. I'm just curious, you know, in this case, you've got the organization, you've got the doctors, you've got the general manager, the coach, the player, his representative. I mean, how many voices are involved to come to a consensus? I'm sure there are a lot of people approaching it from a lot of different viewpoints, with the player, I imagine, having the ultimate say.
Well, that everything you said is true, and in the scheme of things, the player is always the patient, and our allegiance, our responsibility as a medical staff is to the patient, and the organization's responsibility is to player health, and the NBA's responsibility ultimately is to player health, and nobody takes it lightly. I mean, I work really closely with many individuals within the NBA, and I can tell you that player health is akin to one of the most important variables that people are contemplating. The reality is, it's actually not, and the flip side is, it's not always science. And these conversations can be made as simple as sitting down with the athlete, the patient athlete, and saying, look, how are you feeling? Last 48 hours you've been doing all things basketball. Have you had any pain? Has the pain escalated? When you push off a UAD, how do you feel? And the one thing is playing in pain, but one thing is playing in pain and not delivering. So there are some situations where an athlete can play in some degree of discomfort, and he's still an asset to himself and the team. The flip side is when you're putting someone in, and I noticed there was some commentary on this, you put a guy in who isn't delivering to the team, mm-hmm. It makes no sense to put him back to play, right? He can hurt the team, and you're also assuming the also associated risk that he may injure himself and be out longer. So obviously he felt, this is a veteran, he's not going to be pushed or arm wrestled into playing. The risks are explained. He asks the questions. The team, if he doesn't ask the questions, we ask the questions for him and paint various scenarios and say, this is what might have happened. But does it extend beyond that? You know, this is a pretty tight organization. You know, the way I see it, again, is what I read in the media, what I know on the team physician side. I mean, they work really collaboratively. And I believe when I read about it in terms of how the decision's made, and I think it's kind of, the part that I guess I see a little bit unfair, and unfortunately this is the way media sometimes can portray this, is people want answers, and they want heads to roll when things happen like this. And let's face it, this is a high-stakes sport. It's a collision sport. Anytime you walk on the court, an injury can happen. And it's all about relative risk and making the best decisions you can make that are evidence-based, all the while understanding that there's so many things that you and I just cannot control. And that's the crux of it. As long as people recognize and expectations are met. You cannot control all these variables, but this is what we think might or could happen. But understand, this could happen. Is it worth the risk to you as a player, to the organization, to yourself? And then ultimately, it is the player's decision. And I am more than confident it was the player's decision in this case. And I can't think of too many situations where it isn't the player's decision. But you also have to do it in an objective, impartial way. When you're educating a player about return to sport, you can't do it through the lens of I'm a fan or I have a desire to see this team win. You do it through the lens always with that, you know, that responsibility that you're a patient, but who also, by the way, happens to be a professional athlete playing in a championship game where your presence or absence may determine the outcome. That's kind of the way. You know, it's all about you being the patient.
You know it because you lived it, and you know how provincial Chicago is. So yesterday, a lot of the discussion revolved around the comparison to the Derrick Rose situation. Are there parallels to be drawn between Kevin Durant's situation and what Derrick Rose went through?
You know, Derrick's was interesting because he had a number of other injuries, some of them small nagging things, his low back, his foot, his toe. I remember reading an article of someone saying, well, it's because he injured his left toe that he was slanted to the right, and then his back was hurting, and he woke up at 6 a.m. and instead of 7 a.m. and ate some Skittles, and that's why he tore his ACL. I mean, it's crazy. it doesn't work that way. But people, you know, the thing is, our society is immediate information and an if this then that mentality. And I'm going to tell you, I've published probably over 1,000 papers, articles in collaboration with my colleagues at Midwest Orthopedics at Rush. It is so far from if this, then that. There are statistical determinations you can make, but it is not if this, then that. And it goes down to sports science and determining probability and so forth. So, yes, the comparison, at least for Derrick, were that he had a series of decisions, when should I go back? And, you know, those conversations, you know, I don't want to take up too much time, but there's one area that we're really interested in is we publish articles on return to sport. And we say, okay, after you have an ACL, the average return to sport is 8 to 12 months. And then when a guy is not returning at 14 or 16 months, you say, well, something must be wrong, you know, or something's going on. Return to sport is a product of a large number of variables. Who's on the roster? The needs of that player to play at that time? What's the level of competition? When Derrick was returning back to sport, we were in the midst we were doing exhibition games then we were in the playoffs. I felt at one point, and it was at the end, there was no opportunity to really practice him and get him up at, you know, sport ready, for example. So there's the physical determination of being ready to return to sport, and then there's a system that an individual has to return to sport within. And the system, those things are not always aligned. So we can't, that's why we're really discouraging some of these articles about return to sport decisions, because the information is taken from the public domain. And they're taking out of context of the organization. A guy could be a free agent. I don't want to run the risk. You know, why do you think several people don't come to combine and practice? Because they're maybe in part worried about injury, right? Why may they not want to try out for a team? Because they're worried about injury. So all these things have to be weighed in, and people, I think, fail to, they're just not provided the information. It's nobody's fault. It's just is a very deep decision making that goes on, and very hard unless you're right in the middle of it, that it is not really fair to make conclusions and judgments on it. Because, and I'll just tell you in good faith, I think things are done really, really well. I mean, everyone is aware of all these decisions. People are not living in a box. We all know the consequences and what to contemplate. And you can take the same injury, same situation, and come up with a different decision based upon where a roster is, where people are, the winningness of a team, you know, if they've had a bunch of back-to-backs, how many minutes a guy plays, when should you rest him, what should the practice schedule be. You know, you can take the same clinical problem and you'll come up with a different outcome based upon all those variables.
Dr. Cole, thank you a ton. Really appreciate the information.
Great stuff,
very
Brian.
Very enlightening. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Great. Have a great morning. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, David.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.